Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turns blue, grace turns blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I
nonetheless, on this April 4th, 2010, and it's a special edition. I'll be joined by our special co-host, Peter Fowler from Glendale, Arizona, in a brief amount of time. And before we are joined by Peter Fowler, we're going to hit a couple news items, and we'll be joined by Peter Fowler. We'll hit the ground running. We have a lot of stuff to talk about, but this is such a significant day as this marks one of the continuing anniversaries of the assassination of the great Dr. Martin Luther King. And some folks would kind of say, why would I lead off with that? Why would I lead off by saying that This marks the anniversary, you know, dating all the way back to 1968 when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, it's quite easy for me to reply back why I led off with that by not saying that today also happens to be the commonly celebrated holiday of Easter, which we'll get into. But, you know, and there's a lot of mythology and untruth surrounding Easter holiday. Some of the more blatantly funny ones, the amusing ones, have to do with the, you know, so-called Christians, you know, putting in such emphasis on this day. And yet many of them, their children know far more about the Easter Bunny than do, you know, one of the prophets that they rejoice and celebrate, none other than Yeshua ben Yosef, otherwise known as Jesus Christ. But we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about another prophet, Martin Luther King, who was nothing short of a prophet in the same vein of Malcolm X and so many others that we've spent time and will continue to spend time deconstructing and talking about on Your World News. But we're going to pay special homage to Dr. Martin Luther King on this episode of Your World News, and we're going to spend ample time talking about the lore and the mythology that surrounds the Christian holiday known as Easter. And Peter Fowler, who's joining us from Glendale, Arizona, you know, has a unique and expert perspective, being that he is a ordained minister. He's been to seminary school and received his master's degree, and it's been a great deal of time talking about, you know, these things. He spends most of his time talking about the Black liberation theology, or liberation theology, much along the lines of Dr. James Cone, who hopefully a lot of you guys are familiar with. If not, definitely Google Dr. James Cone, C-O-N-E, and really get yourself up to speed with the inimitable work that he's done surrounding Black liberation or liberation theology. So anyways, without further ado, I'd like to start off with a couple of clips before we really get into the meat and to the bulk of our conversation. I'd be remiss if I didn't start off with a couple of clips that we got from Brother Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. And matter of fact, we're going to start off with my brother, Dr. Jared Ball, and this very, very on-point analysis that he does entitled Cultural Genocide that was in this past week's Black Agenda Report. And I say every single week, and I'll continue to say every week, if you're not familiar with Black Agenda Report, you need to familiarize yourself with Black Agenda Report, www.blackagendareport.com. Without further ado, here is Dr. Jared Ball.
All the corny laptop DJs that killed the realness. I found this comment from Washington, D.C.-based DJ U-Rock about DJs adopting new digital technology as opposed to the traditional vinyl record to be quite relevant, far beyond its immediate focus of the closing of DJ Hut, the longtime mainstay of DJ and hip-hop culture in the city. Perhaps it hit harder considering that only a couple of weeks earlier, one of D.C.'s more prominent go-go music sound men told me that go-go as a culture is going to die. In each case, the impact of gentrification and new technologies were seen by those who would know to be having a nasty impact that goes well beyond the ravages of uprooted community. To the extent that D.C. represents a national trend in all that is related to issues of gentrifying communities in what has even been likened to an international return to the European model of cities for the wealthy and suburbs for the rest, the nation's capital also exemplifies the impact on culture of colonial relocation and land grabbing. Of course, the cultural expression of Black people has long been a battleground of theft and appropriation, and, as all uninterrupted processes, it continues today. In this case, the long history of racial cleansing in the United States has a style and impact that is equally modern in its creeping and slick demeanor. For instance, Washington, D.C. has been targeted as one of Clear Channel's branded cities, or the plan for complete corporate advertising immersion, where brandscaping turns communal spaces into controlled environments where brands are to be experienced and unavoidably interwoven into people's daily lives. This is the live version of what some lament as the creeping shift of sleeker, more convenient, and accessible DJ digital technology, which encompasses the closing of record stores, which as all public spheres means so much more than a place to purchase albums. It also includes the policy of cleansing the city of its most recognizable cultural expression. Go-Go, with its live musicianship, polyrhythmic conga-based funk, has, according to soundman Greg McNeils, been all but banned from the city proper. Bands are literally told to leave their congas at home in order to reform themselves as jazz or R&B bands, and the famed Pocket, Go-Go's equivalent to hip-hop's breakbeat, is said to now be off-limits. And similar to UROC's dismay at the shift to digital formats, McNeils describes a similar trend where street vendors and small store operators are being forced out of business, which in turn hurts the underground distribution of Go-Go mixtapes or PA-taped recordings of live performances, which have been the mass medium network of distribution for those without access to radio. And he is not alone. Cats have been seeing this. Odyssey of the crew Diamond District recounts how mom-and-pop stores are replaced by couture, and Headrock, the mayor of D.C. hip-hop, who himself has lyrically tackled the issue of gentrification, has recently launched a campaign to expose the vicious network of venue operators who continue to deny local black artists space to perform and who assure that those who do are held in a state of electric purgatory or debt peonage as they must cover their own promotional costs or perceived lack of audience draw. And all of this is slickly hidden beneath DC's tightly controlled media environment, which is quite right-wing in general and specifically managed to assure that none of this music is heard on the city's sanctioned radio. Just this past week, as is the case every week, the dominant urban radio stations had all their top 10 songs as measured by times played or spins, selected by one of three corporations, two of whom, Sony Music CEO Howard Stringer and Warner Music's CEO Edgar Bronfman, share an incestuous board of director interlock. But the issue really is the impact of this nation's brand of colonialism and how it manifests the cultural genocide as defined by the United Nations, who explain it as the imposition of an alien national pattern, which includes all policies aimed at destroying the specific characteristic by which a target group is defined or defines itself, thereby forcing them to become something else. This includes assaults on the target population's books, language, religious works, destruction or dispersion of objects of artistic value, and so on. Shifts in technology which force cultural reformations, that also force limitations of the public sphere, that impose alien cultural forms, or in this case, bastardized corporate versions of the cultural expression, that disappear underground communicative traditions and again force a removal of the drum, all relate to the physical forced removal of colonized populations. And as the nation's capital, as goes D.C., so goes the black nation. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. Online, visit www.blackagendareport.com.
And Jared was right on with that. I mean, as he, you know, someone that lives in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, you know, who was an outsider when I first moved to this area in terms of really understanding, you know, how important Go-Go was to the endemic culture of D.C., you know, I totally have to co-sign on what Jared said, because that has been something that I've noticed, you know, since living here, gradually and more gradually. You can see, you know, Go-Go, the attempt to phase out Go-Go from the so-called mainstream outlets becoming more and more prevalent. But that, as Jared Ball, you know, made the inference in terms of so goes D.C., so goes the rest of the nation in terms of black communities and attacks on black communities from everything from the cultural artifacts, pop culture, if you will, everything from hip hop to go-go. You know, this goes all the way back to the real derivation of rock and roll, and those of us who study music, you know that rock and roll, without a doubt, was an African American creation. So you know, you had the likes of Pat Boone and Alan Freed who felt that R&B, rhythm and blues was quite frankly too black. It was too black. And so what they had to do was they had to change the name, and they changed it to rock and roll. And you know, Chuck Berry is the real father of rock and roll. If you guys didn't know, he is the real father of rock and roll. But they had to lighten it. They had to whiten the name. And then you know, you saw the usurping and the you know and the, just the purloining of R&B from black Americans being stolen by mainstream elite white America and then reshaped and remodeled. And so we see that. We see much of that that is going on right now with hip-hop and has been going on, you know, strongly, especially since after the 1996 Telecommunications Act, where any radio station before the Telecom Act of 1996 could own 20 AM, 20 FM radio stations. Which really allowed radio stations that were owned by people of color, black folks, and so forth, even radio stations that were owned by women, to have an opportunity to get their messages out, maybe not with the same power in terms of monetary backing that some of these corporations had, such as Clear Channel, but. We saw the passing of that Telecom Act by the Newt Gingrich-led Congress being rubber-stamped very easily with no fight from Bill Clinton. We see that how black ownership of radio just died off, dropped significantly by about 70% within the next 2 to 3 years. And so this is, and then with that, we see the changing of the guard, how hip-hop has, you know, we had the golden era of hip-hop in the late 80s, very early 90s, being radically changed and shaped into something that was more acceptable for white America. And that was the image of black and brown-skinned men and women rapping about senseless violence, rapping about misogyny, directed towards black and brown skinned women, sexism, drug sales, all these different things. That was the cookie cutter mold. That was the cookie cutter mold. Without any kind of balance to counter it in any shape, form, or fashion, that was the mold. If you wanted to be signed by one of the major record labels that was now white owned, that came in there and bought out everything from records record labels to radio stations, if you were a black artist or a brown skin artist, you had that was, and you wanted to get played on the radio, that was one of the better ways of doing so, and the cookie cutter and the fix was in. So and that's now when you look at corporate media that plays hip hop, everything from Viacom, when I say Viacom, I'm talking about BET, MTV, VH1. We look at the Clear Channels. Clear Channel went from, as I said, only 40 radio stations after the signing of the Telecommunications Act. They now own over 1,200 radio stations. And so they're not playing the empowering, uplifting, and dare I say, the resistance-laden music that is out there. They have marginalized, they have omitted, they have suppressed and repressed those images because that is not the popular image of black men and black women, brown-skinned men and brown-skinned women, that they want to be out there. That is not the popular image, because that popular image psychologically is a BITCH. And so, anyways, that's, you know, I kind of went off on a tangent, but it's all connected to Jared Ball's piece. And so I really hope folks that are listening right now take a strong listen and kind of deconstruct what Jerry Ball said and listen to it over and over again by going to Black Agenda Report and starting to do your own research, because this is really something that has been underway for a long, long time. And if we don't taken interest in this, we will continue to have our minds and subconsciouses co-opted by those who have no good intentions for us. And so, anyway, speaking of no good intentions for us, such as that of these bastardized, stabilized, Europeanized Western holidays that somehow we feel obligated to celebrate every year, every April, every December. I think that today being a day that's known as Easter, I think that it's a great day to have this dialogue. And Peter, who has just joined us from Glendale, Arizona, you know, he's going to sink his teeth into us for sure, because he's done a great deal of research and writing and speaking about these such holidays and the myths that surround them. But I think even more important, and Peter and I will get into this is that we're going to touch on Easter, just as we touched on Christmas in December. But, you know, it is what it is. We're not going to spend a great deal of time on Easter, because, beyond the fact that we want folks to understand that the true derivations of these holidays. But I think the more important thing is to talk about why we don't celebrate folks, prophets like Martin Luther King as we should on this day, and why we have continued to allow ourselves to be co-opted and to be inertia-laden when it comes to breaking out of the mold. Just because something has been common to your entire life does not mean it's right, does not mean it's true, and does not mean that you should not move away from that and adopt some new habits that are good for your mind, for your conscience, and ultimately good for your community. Because I think that, and this may be unpopular, but I think that continuing to just celebrate these holidays that really basically to a lot of Christians, you know, have no more meaning than anything than just to be cosmetic at best. And so, Peter, I introduced before you came on the show, and I'm glad that you joined us just at the right time. I gave the audience a little bit about your background in terms of you're going to seminary school, the master's degree that you hold, and your affection to liberation theology and folks like James Cone. And so I'd like you to jump in and kind of, if you can, give us your take on the Eastern holiday or the Easter holiday, and why it is more myth and fable than it is a holiday that really a lot of folks think that they're celebrating everything from the Easter Bunny to the resurrection of the Christian prophet Jesus Christ.
My pleasure, Solomon. And this is an important endeavor that we not simply allow holidays like this to go by over the course of the calendar year unquestioned. It's important that we stop and ask, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Because behind some of these prefabricated holidays like Easter and Christmas, there is some very significant information that if we deconstruct the holiday itself, particularly from a historical perspective, we're left with more questions than answers. So, you know, why do people do this so-called Easter holiday? Why is it even called Easter? I mean, what is really going on here? And obviously, the Christian celebration is an observation of the bodily resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth from the grave. He was crucified on Friday, which the Christian church holds as Good Friday, and the biblical narrative tells us that several of his followers went to the tomb on the first day of the week, and found that his tomb was empty. And so that is where the resurrection narrative comes out of. And it is the cornerstone of fundamental or traditional or orthodox Christian theology, is the belief that, that Jesus of Nazareth was physically resurrected, raised from the grave, that he was in fact killed on the cross. He was executed. And that's another thing that it's important for us to know, is that his death on the cross on that Friday, that's known as Good Friday now, was an execution. He was murdered by the state. At that point in history, the state was the Roman Empire. And crucifixion was the form of execution for dissidents, for radicals, for insurgents. And he was murdered like a common criminal, like a insurgent would have been. And so that gives us some insight into who Jesus, the historical Jesus, who he really was. A religious radical would not have been executed like an enemy of the state. And Jesus was. So we have to ask that question. Yet and still, that's not what is emphasized. What is emphasized is what happened on the first day of the week, or Sunday, keeping in mind that in the calendar of antiquity, Sunday is the first day of the week. Also keeping in mind the Hebrew concept of night and day and of time was important, that Jesus was dead for 3 days and then rose 3 days later. And even though the math is a little fuzzy, it doesn't quite add up. If Jesus was crucified sometime on Friday and was the grave was empty on Sunday, that doesn't give us 3 full days. And that's just that gets kind of glossed over when the church talks about that particular theology. But nevertheless, it's all very symbolic in terms of his being in the grave 3 days, that the grave being empty. And so these were constructs that the early church developed in order to cement the place of Jesus as the Messiah, the one who was prophesied about in the Old Testament. Now, the historical Jesus, that's a whole other conversation. And so what we're left with, Solomon, to cut to the chase, is this Easter holiday based off of that narrative, that story, that that Jesus was resurrected physically, bodily, from the grave, that he was in fact dead, but was raised back to life by God. And so that is, one of the cornerstones of the Christian belief system. And so how do we get from that to Easter? And I think that's the question we need to look at today, is what is this holiday with bunnies and with eggs, Easter eggs and chocolate and baskets for the kids with toys and your Sunday best, a new Easter hat, you know, and all the trappings of a very materialistic, commercialized Western holiday. Where is the connection? I think that's what we want to get into tonight, is to look at how we got from the resurrection of an enemy of the state in Jesus of Nazareth to Easter bunnies, chocolate eggs, and brand new hats. And so what we see over the course of time is a mongrelization of this observation of the resurrection. The early church needed to make its claim of authenticity. And the resurrection was the cornerstone of that. That was a way of elevating Jesus to the status of divinity. If Jesus, in fact, was resurrected physically and bodily from the grave, then he is unique among all of the other persons that were elevated to the status of deity, the status of God. Jesus of Nazareth is now unique because no one else has ever been raised from the grave. You know, all of the other religious figures and the so-called gods and holy men, Muhammad being one example. You know, you have Christians in their conversations with Muslims bring that up. They say, well, Muhammad died and stayed dead, right? With Jews, they would say, you know, Abraham died and stayed dead. Moses died and stayed dead. But Jesus died and was resurrected. Jesus died and came back to life. So it's the historical reality of that that we certainly need to call into question. But just to emphasize why that holiday, why Easter is so important, and then to look at this form of Easter that we have today. First of all, the name Easter. You know, the name Easter has nothing to do with anything from a Judaic, Christian, linguistic, or cultural background at all. The word Easter is borrowed from a Saxon language. Easter was a Saxon goddess. And everybody's familiar with the term Anglo-Saxons. You know, it's often used as a blanket term for white people, as Anglo-Saxons. Well, the Angles and the Saxons were tribes in Western Europe of Europeans. And so the Saxons had their religions, and Easter was a goddess in that religion. And there was a spring celebration that was correlated with the spring equinox. And so the Christian church, as it moved west into Europe, adopted a number of other beliefs and practices into its own, under its own umbrella, if you will, in order to make itself more attractive to the non-Christians. It was trying to proselytize in order to develop points of continuity with non-Christian religions, with some of the indigenous religions. As the church moved across Europe, there was those intentions to make connections with other religions, so that it didn't seem so foreign and so alien. And so here come all of a sudden now this name is adopted. Just like when we talked about Christmas, why is Christmas, the birth of Jesus, celebrated in December? There's no historical evidence whatsoever that Jesus of Nazareth was born in December.
Right.
That's a complete fabrication in order to match up with some of the holidays later on that conveniently were already there. The same thing with Sunday being the day for worship, because the Bible talks about, you know, the first day of the week. And so we see a borrowing of traditions and ideas and observations from other religions that the Christian church kind of co-opted into their own theology. And so that's what we have with Easter today. You know, we have the Easter bunny, we have these Easter eggs, and they're all very tangential at best in their relationship to the biblical narrative, and sometimes not at all, as is the example with the name itself, with the name of Easter. So the Christian holiday that we have today is based off of the original narrative that claims that Jesus of Nazareth was raised bodily from the grave. And we do need to look at the historicity of that and why that claim was made by the followers of Jesus. There were a number of Christian sects, small subgroups, that did not believe in bodily resurrection of Jesus. That didn't become orthodox Christian belief until several centuries after Jesus was executed. And so it wasn't made a uniform belief for hundreds of years after the execution and the claimed resurrection of Jesus. So we see a uniformity developing in Christian belief, and we see a co-opting or a borrowing of traditions and beliefs and practices from other religions and other cultures over the course of time. And that's where we are today, Solomon. We're in the 21st century with this holiday that, you know, if Jesus could come back, or any of his followers to come back and see the ridiculous things that people who claim to be his modern day followers, the things that they do, they would just scratch their heads. They wouldn't know what is going on. And yet and still, it is a good church folk who think they're being good church folk, think they're being good Christians by following all of these various traditions that are associated with the Easter holiday. And so those are the questions we need to ask, and those are the things we need to look at.
Right. And without any kind of, you know, question whatsoever, you know, I was raised, you know, in the Christian mold, and and you know, my spirituality, I've always said, is something between myself and the Most High, who I worship. But in relationship to this show, you know, I have no qualms, you know, mentioning that I was raised in a very much in a Christian household, but that household was very open to us developing our own way of worship, which was something very different than a lot of my friends. You know what I'm saying? A lot of my friends, it was very austere. It was very, you know, an austere way of worship and very rote and kind of disciplined in terms of, you know, sticking to the mold and not deviating in any shape, form, or fashion. But thank God, like, in, you know, no pun intended, you know, in my household, it was much different in terms of I was given flexibility to see how I wanted to worship to God, Yahweh, whatever, you know what I'm saying, Allah, whatever someone refers to that higher being, that the Most High. And it was years later, like probably, you know, towards my right around my initial college years when I started to really, you know, learn about, you know, like what the hell is this, like, you know, and I started really to question, like, what the hell is this Easter Bunny really have to do? And then doing research and finding some common strands that saw that, you know, just like you mentioned, you know, in those European tribes, that the bunny came to you know, in their attempt to, as you know, just like with Christmas, to try to win over pagans. And as we know, pagans, you know, is just kind of like a reference to like nature, and that's where you got the symbol of the Christmas tree, you know.
Right.
But looking at the, you know, and so the bunny was a sign of fertility, and you know, learning about that, and it just really didn't make sense to me how so many families that I would observe, even at a quasi young age, is like observing so many families that would really go out of their way to profess and proclaim themselves as strict, you know what I'm saying, very faithful Christians, but at the same time had really inculcated and to their kids at the very least allowed their kids to believe that, you know what I'm saying, that the Easter Bunny was like, you know, the most significant part of that holiday. You know what I'm
right.
saying? And, you know, it just kind of blew my mind, just like, you know, at Christmas time. I mean, Santa Claus is the most significant part, bar none. I mean, this is really, like, irrefutable that Santa Claus is the most significant part of most, you know, American children's, you know, holiday, where most Christian American, you know, children, the 25th, I mean, that's what they're looking forward to. To Santa Claus, this big white fat dude, you know, coming through a chimney, you know, let alone if you don't have a chimney, he's still coming.
Right.
It just really, really bizarre to me. And then when you really start to, like, you know, and really look at religion itself and the formation of religion and how, you know, even looking at the Bible and how many different times, I mean, that was something that stuck out to me, you know, I think at age 17, 18, is that, you know, well, if this thing is supposed to be the word and we're supposed to, you know what I'm saying, really stick by this, why is there a different version? You know what I'm saying? Because, you know what I'm saying, why is there a King James version? That was the first question I asked. And then I found out how many different times it had been written and interpreted to fit different populations. And then that's when, like, to me, the real fix was in. And I was like, you know, you know, that's when I was like, you know, this whole thing, this, under the auspices of the umbrella of Christianity, when you look at Catholicism and Protestants, and this, you know what I'm saying, that denomination, it just, Peter, just really progressively made less and less sense to me.
It will make less and less sense. I think but the first step is to ask those questions and to go into it with your eyes wide open, your ears wide open, and your mind wide open to ask the questions, what's really going on here, and what's significant, Solomon, is to not be afraid of what you might find on the other side. not be terrified by the facts that might disprove what millions of people hold to be the truth, or what so many people believe and cling to. Because as we deconstruct all those various things, we look at the denominations, we look at the different theologies and different doctrines, they will make less and less sense the more we take them apart and to see where they're coming from. And you know, Easter and Christmas are two of the best starting points to do that. And what's significant is we look at the Christian tradition of observing Holy Week, what the church calls Holy Week, that week from the one Sunday ago, what's referred to as Palm Sunday, and the week leading up to Easter, including Good Friday and then Easter Sunday. And it is so devoid of cultural context that it's virtually lost all meaning. And so because of that void in real historical meaning, and I'm talking about the context out of which Holy Week arose and the Jewish Passover festival around which, you know, the whole historical happenings of that week in the biblical narrative took place. Those are completely written out of Christian tradition, and so there's no historical context, and that's why I think part of the reason why that some of these other non-biblical and European traditions kind of have made their way into this Easter holiday, because you know most Christian folks don't realize that the Last Supper, which many folks will celebrate or observe on what some Protestant churches call Maundy Thursday, the Thursday before Easter. They don't realize, they don't understand the connection between that and the Jewish Passover that's found in the book of Exodus, and that the Jewish faith still celebrates every year, even today. And the church just basically has written that out of its tradition, of its history, and I think much to its detriment. When I was active in the church, that was one of the things that I tried to emphasize, was the historical and cultural connections of Christianity to its roots in Judaism, in what Christians call the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
And so, you know, looking back, we can see how Christianity became a very uniform. And then it started to take on some of these other tradition and cultural influences. And yet and still, some of the good church folk who are in church on Easter Sunday, if there's, you know, everybody who's been to church knows that Easter and Christmas are the 2 days of the year when everybody goes to church, right? And it's as if though going to church on those two particular holidays is going to get one right with God, you know. And what I want to look at today, because of the date on today's calendar, to the fact that today is April 4th, is another day that the Christian church and American culture in general has ignored. And most folks don't even know the significance of April 4th, just like most Christian folks don't know the significance of the Passover meal and the significance of someone being executed via crucifixion on a cross and what that means. All those things are written out, and those are written out in order to continue to uphold the power structure of the church, because if folks really understood what was going on with Jesus, the dissident, the insurgent, and why he was executed as an enemy of the state, things would be a lot different. Now, let's talk about another individual who was not executed but assassinated on April 4th. On this date, you do the math for me, bro. 1968, April 4th, Martin Luther King was shot down. So I like to observe April 4th and a number of other days throughout the calendar years as bullet days. So, you know, today is, for some folks, it's Easter. For me, it's Bullet Day. You know, an American prophet was shot down, was taken out with a bullet on today. And a year before that, 1 year to the day prior to that, April 4th, 1967, was Martin's, what we might call his coming out party, or his coming out sermon against the war on the Vietnamese people. spoke at the Riverside Church in New York City, and delivered the Time to Break Silence sermon. And what is significant, Solomon, in the context of our conversation, what I find so striking is that it was the good church folk, black and white, came out in opposition of Martin Luther King after he gave that after he delivered that sermon that spoke out against the war in Vietnam. Now, these are good church folk, including a lot of church leadership, ministers, priests, from Baptist traditions, Episcopalian traditions, you name it, from all the churches under the Christian umbrella, came out and criticized Martin Luther King for speaking out against the war in Vietnam, for speaking out against American imperialism. And these are the same folks who were up in church every Sunday, including Easter Sunday, and claimed to be followers of Jesus of Nazareth, who himself was executed as an enemy of the state because of his insurgent tendencies and his movement that was a political movement. A lot of people don't want to hear that. Folks don't want to hear that Jesus was political, that his movement was political. Well, it was. If you know your history and you know your Bible, you know that the Jesus movement was a social and a political movement. And the fact is clear. He wouldn't have been executed on a cross if it weren't a political movement and he weren't seen by the Roman state as an insurgent, as a dissident. So it's those facts that, to me, make the church leadership so hypocritical that when they came out against Martin Luther King and against King's position against the war on the Vietnamese people, and that they criticized him and said that he had overstepped his bounds, they said that he is no longer of use to the movement for civil rights, for black liberation in America, that he he didn't have the right or the license to speak on foreign policy. I think what that does is it tells us just how shallow the Christian church is and how shallow the leadership of the Christian church is, and that their commitment is actually to the empire of the United States of America rather than the truth of the gospel that they claim to follow. So it's timely and it's significant that we look at that, given the fact that today, Easter Sunday, is April 4th, and what Martin Luther King stood for and the way he was and the way the church distanced itself from the great Martin Luther King.
This is where I wanted to get into. This is the part that the folks, when I let off, what I was really looking forward to getting into on this day, April 4th, because when before you join us, Pete, I let off by saying this is a significant day because this is the anniversary of the assassination of the prophet Dr. Martin Luther
right.
King Jr. And I said that probably a lot of folks were probably expecting me to say that Easter. This was Easter, but no, to me this day being April 4th is a very significant day, given the fact that yes, Dr. Martin Luther King was killed on this day in 1968, and it's not to dismiss any. And as I said, I keep my words are very close to the vest, and it's a very personal thing, I think, to a lot of folks, including myself. And so it's not to diss people who are Christian or who celebrate this day as Easter. What it is to try to get folks to try to step outside their comfort zone and to step outside that box and to look at that box with some analytical lenses and to really question and to search and to, if you can think back to where you were given the idea about Christmas and Christianity in general and Christmas, to step outside and to, like, when you search to the roots, most likely when you think back as far as you can, it was something that you were kind of inherited through family routine and rituals and so forth. And quite frankly, based on my studies and studies on top of those studies and studies on top of the, I see a lot of fable and mythology tied into Christianity. But beyond that, so even if it is, you know what I'm saying, even if someone doesn't want to believe me that there are a lot of fable and mythology connected to Christianity and quite frankly the Bible, you know, if you, I think it would be more apropos if people just kind of looked at some of those stories as inspirational stories. So sometimes we read books of fiction and we find inspiration in a character that was in a book, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, or a movie such as V for Vendetta, you know what I'm saying? People became inspired by that character, you know, fighting against and bucking the system, fighting against the system and find that. Some people find inspiration in DC Comics and so forth. And I'm not necessarily equating the Bible with a comic book, but I am comparing and contrasting that there are some very, 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 very questionable aspects of the Bible historically. And even as Peter gave a very, like, one of the more simple, I guess, conflicting aspects of the Bible and looking at the story of Easter, I mean, the story of Easter and the 3 days and, you know, Friday not matching up with three full days to Sunday. And that's very minor compared to some of the other stories that you can find in the Bible that just don't, you know what I'm saying, historically mesh. But if you're looking at the Bible from that perspective, that some of these stories may be right on and some may be more myth than they are fact. But in the same token, you're finding inspiration in some of these stories. You're finding inspiration through resistance or this, that, and the other. And it's and not necessarily taking everything literal, because when you look at even some of the stories in the Bible, if you take the literal interpretation, you know, dare I say, it's it could really lead you up a very interesting path. But to get to Dr. King, we know was a very real individual, and yes, he was a man of the cloth. He was a man of the Christian faith. He was a preacher. We know all this. You know what I'm saying? Found an organization, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so he undeniably was a Christian, but that did not stop him in any shape, form, or fashion from speaking truth to power. And so, there was a strong thread of resistance within much of the late Dr. Martin Luther King's life, you know what I'm saying, in the latter years, when you especially even look in the last 5 years of his life, and this is really important, I'm glad you brought this up, Peter, is that had he not been killed that day, he was working on a subsequent speech that was supposed to be after that.
Right.
That was due to be entitled, yeah, Why America May Go to Hell. His
right.
Next speech that he was working on delivering, the title of that speech was Why America May, and emphasized the word may go to hell. And that's really interesting. And those of you guys that are folks of, like, you know, television and so forth, you know, Tavis Smiley actually just did a pretty decent piece on Dr. King and his life and especially, like, one of the least known speeches that but dare I say the most important speech that he ever gave was, you know, that one on April 4th, 1967, beyond Vietnam, Breaking the Silence. Tavis Smiley just did a special around that was on PBS. And, you know, so, you know, those of us that are, if you're online right now, you're definitely resourceful enough to Google that. And I think you could probably find it online. It's just really definitely interesting to watch that and to see where the whole mythology, since we were talking about the mythology that is lined up with much of the Bible and some aspects of Christianity, at the very least, how Christians in this country celebrate Christianity, because Christians in this country seem to celebrate their faith as if it was mythology. And so they might get mad at me, Peter, for saying mythology, but it's funny that they're the same folks that allow their children to worship Santa Claus, who is a mythological character. And so it's really the hypocrisies are abound. But Dr. King, man, the mythology that I was going to speak on is what happened in 2008 when we saw the juxtapositions on these fabulous and mythological T-shirts that had Dr. King and Obama, side by side, or even some of the ones that had this so-called triumvirate, Dr. King, Malcolm X, and Obama, and it was just to compare Dr. King and Obama, or to compare Obama and Dr. King, is just ludicrous. The man, you know what I'm saying, as you alluded to, Peter, the man alluded to militarization, excessive materialism. I mean, and taking a shot at capitalism within that. You know what I'm saying? Without a doubt, and obviously, and racism. That is these things that are latent, and those were like the triocar that he mentioned in terms of the evils that America is plagued with. And we have this wartime president who has his fingerprint, his DNA all over Afghanistan now. I mean, for God's sakes, he sent in, you know what I'm saying, an extra 40 to 50,000 troops. I mean, there's like close to 150,000 troops there right now in Afghanistan, U.S. troops. And each one, it costs taxpayers no less than $900,000 per year per troop. $900,000 per year per troop to fight this illegal occupation in Afghanistan. And you're going to try to tell me that you're going to put on a T-shirt, on a black cotton T-shirt, thick heavy cotton T-shirt, and walk around where it has Dr. King's picture next to Barack Obama and try to compare the two in the same vein. It almost made me throw up. It's a joke.
The only connection there, if Dr. King were around today, would be his clear condemnation of Barack Obama's policies. There's no question about it. So to try to link King and Obama in the American imagination is a very dangerous thing. But yet still, it's very effective. You know, we see that on the T-shirt. We see people believing it. Why? Because they don't know their history. Because they don't know the facts. You know, and there's some very strong similarities there too, with in terms of how Christianity, once it became the official religion, once it became the state religion of the Roman Empire, you know, the Roman Empire could basically create the narrative around it. And we saw that with Dr. King. Once Dr. King was assassinated, the empire against which he railed against and who he prophesied against and struggled to bring down the walls that the empire has built up between its own citizens, and, you know, the walls of poverty and the walls of racism, the walls of materialism and militarism. It was that same empire, that same country, that same culture that has claimed Dr. King as their own. You know, so we see things like George Bush Jr. speaking at the King Center on the Martin Luther King holiday just a few years ago. I mean, which is, you talk about a ridiculous juxtaposition. You know, George Bush Jr. speaking at the King Center on Martin Luther King holiday. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so what has happened is there's some very striking similarities between the way Jesus was co-opted and the way the reality of the historical Jesus was twisted and written in such a way, rewritten in such a way that it serves the purposes and the agenda of the empire, of the Roman Empire, and then later on the various other empires of the West, including our own right now. And the same thing with Dr. King, the way he has been crystallized in time. You know, the king that America remembers because of the king that is propagated in the American narrative and American culture, in our imaginations, our popular imaginations, the king we're taught about in school and so forth, is the king who's standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August of 1963 talking about, "I have a dream." And that's pretty much the extent to which we know about that most people know of Dr. King and his legacy. You know, marching through the streets in these nonviolent demonstrations and holding hands and clutching arms, you know, and singing "We Shall Overcome." And that's only a small fraction of who Martin Luther King was and what he stood for and what the movement that he was at the head of stood for. And it's the same thing with Jesus. You know, the Jesus that has been crystallized in the American imagination is one who is what? You know, what's the common image of Jesus? You know, this meek, mild, weepy-eyed, pitiful-looking, you know, pale-faced, blonde-haired, blue-eyed character. You know, and he's nothing. The historical Jesus was nothing like that. You know, phenotypically or in personality, nor in his mission. And you know, I mean, again, why was he executed on the cross? Not because he was meek and mild and sweet and tender. You know, he was executed on a cross because he was a political dissident. And, you know, so this, and the same thing is true with Dr. King. You know, why was he allowed to be shot down? I mean, you know, the U.S. government said that Martin Luther King is the most dangerous man in America. Now, you know, a religious man who just wants to see little black boys and little black girls play together is not a dangerous man. But a man who comes out and speaks loud and clear his opposition to the war on the Vietnamese people, and a man who says he's going to shut down Washington and shut down the capital of states and other major cities across this country in an effort to bring equity and inequality and justice to the poor people of this country, that's a dangerous man. And that's what Martin Luther King was about. And he was walking in the steps of the Jesus of the Bible that he knew about. He was walking in the footsteps of the freedom fighter from Nazareth, Jesus of Nazareth, is who I'm talking about. Not the weepy-eyed, meek and mild, pitiful character who you know, folks go to church on Easter Sunday. And what I have an issue with, Solomon, and you and I have talked about this before, is the Messiah complex that the Easter narrative has bred in the Christian church and not just with Christians but across the board, this thinking that if we have a Messiah, if we have a Savior, then that Savior, that Messiah, this Jesus in this case, is going to come and save us. And so, you know, we don't need to fight, we don't need to struggle, we don't need to be out in the streets fighting and struggling on a day-to-day basis. Because why? Because Jesus is our Savior, you know, and he's going to come at the end of time, and he's going to come in God's timing and, you know, and make everything right. Well, what does that do? Whose agenda does that serve? That serves the agenda of the state for folks to just sit around and wait on their Savior, you know.
Exactly.
And so that has been a deadly rewriting of history by the Christian church, you know, basically by the empire through the Christian church. You know, those first centuries that Christianity was institutionalized, Jesus was defanged or declawed, if you will, or emasculated, really. I call that period of time the Constantinian castration, because it was Emperor Constantine in the 4th century who castrated the Christian movement, the Jesus movement, by making Jesus into this character, this harmless, feeble character that the real historical Jesus was not. And we've seen the same thing with Martin Luther King today, that he's
right.
been turned into this harmless, adorable guy who has a dream about folks getting along together. And so, you know, there's some very strong parallels between Jesus and the memory of Jesus, side by side with Martin Luther King and the memory of Martin Luther King.
Exactly, and I think that those of us who have taken the time to analyze, you know, elected officials, whether it's on a local level, state level, or a federal level, taking the time to analyze, you know, these elected officials, you know, leading up to any major major election, and most well known to America is always the presidential election. I think it's the responsibility of us that have taken that time and have really looked at Barack Obama and the coming of Barack Obama as a U.S. senator, and then now as the president of the United States of America, and really juxtaposing his policies and his stance with the needs and concerns of those that we find in Black and Brown communities, it's quite clear that his administration's policies are not lock in step with what we need to see in terms of government intervention that would really help boost up those communities and get them, you know, the resources and support and legislation that they need to be freed from everything from police brutality and racial profiling to the revamping and revitalizing and rebuilding of public schools. You know, I say public schools, not charter schools.
Right.
I think it's our responsibility to question them. You know what I'm saying? I've heard from people tell me that, you know, I go too hard on Obama, but that's my responsibility. That's my duty. You know what I'm saying?
And you're right, it is.
It counters the bull crap that's out there in the mainstream media.
And what am I
not going to talk about his policies that are like, what, you know what I'm saying? I mean, and so it's up to, you know, small-minded folks if they want to, you know, get caught up in that, or if they want to actually, you know what I'm saying, say, you know what, you know, I'm going to look into this, you know. But what I found is most people, unfortunately, they get caught up in that and they then just label you as an Obama hater and walk around the same damn fools they were before then because they don't wish to go and look it up and say, let me go to thomas.gov. Did he really vote like that when he was a senator? Did he really vote like that? Damn, you know, he did, you know, but most people don't do that. And so, I mean, I really give a damn whether I'm labeled as, you know what I'm saying, as the inconvenient hero. I mean, that's what I want to be. I want to be the inconvenient hero. So if it ruffles some people's feathers that I'm criticizing Obama harsh. I mean, these you know, what's funny, Peter, is these are the same MFers that would criticize George Bush every freaking day. Every freaking day. And go on and in detail why, you know what I'm saying, what Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Rove and all what they're doing, rightfully so, they would hold forth in their community, talk to their friends, this, that, and the other. But then there I question this phenotypically brown skinned man, you know what I'm saying, more than they're liking and get into his policies. But then, and then, you know, and, but and here's the thing, Peter, I always talk about solutions beyond. I mean, that's, as you know, I mean, that's what I've been trained to do, is to be solutions oriented. So I always get into that, like, you know, what are the solutions to this? And I always, you know, talk, you know, and I would always follow up with solutions oriented things. Register yourself as an independent, or register yourself with an alternative party. And so you give them solutions or things that they can do, tiny, tiny, tiny steps incrementally to break away from the mainstream political two-party system. And the first thing they do is say, oh, I can't vote for a loser.
Right.
You're voting for the lesser of two evils, the evil two lessers. That is a loser move. Whether you like it or not, that is a loser move. You know, so it's just, you know, it's just, and Dr. King, and it's funny, man. It's Peter, and this is, and I'm on this, Peter, it's just interesting. It's just the hypocrisy that people don't want. They want to talk about Martin and Malcolm, and but yet, the same token, run away from all of their ideologies and philosophies. And you can't talk about these people being, you know, heroes or icons, whatever, and you sit there and you run away from their philosophies. Dr. King was the same man that said, "Listen, if you know about evil that's going on and you choose not to speak out against it, you're just as bad as the perpetrators of it."
That's
so
right.
You know what I'm saying? So me question Obama, you know what I'm saying, whether it's 6 days in a row or whatever, and his policies and articulating his policies, that's lock and step with, you know, some of what Dr. King talked about and what
sure it is. Sure it is. You know, and you know, we see the I think we see a little bit of that messiah syndrome in the since Obama's been elected. We've seen that in the black community. We talked about it on this show just a few weeks ago about some of the leaders from the black community, namely Al Sharpton, and the leaders from the Urban League and the NAACP, went and had an audience with Barack Obama, the President of the United States, and made no demands on him. You know, that's the first time in the last 40-some years that the leadership, the recognized leadership of the black community, hasn't held the president's feet to the fire and said, no, these are our demands. You know, and the black community, much of the black community, has sort of stepped away from the struggle. The anti-war movement has stepped away from the struggle. And it's because, I think, by and large, there's that misconception that because Barack Obama's elected, that he's going to make everything all right. And it's that same kind of messiah syndrome that leads many Christians to not act, that leads many, that causes folks to say, well, you know what, he's going to do it for us. And that's a big problem. And, you know, obviously not everybody's like that. There's still a lot of people out there struggling. There's still a lot of people out there that are on the front lines. But that's one of the dangers of having that kind of a belief system, that somebody is going to come down from on high, whether it's from come down from heaven like Jesus, or come, you know, ascend to the White House from, you know, the halls of power in some alternative political framework, which why people would think Obama was from an alternative political framework is beyond me, like you pointed out, just because he has more pigment than John McCain or anybody else, you know, is ludicrous. Yet still, it's common, and so many people have backed down from the struggle, assuming or expecting Barack Obama to do it himself. And, you know, not only, you know, we do him a disservice. And Cornel West published an interview. You can look it up on YouTube. You know, it's a few weeks old now, but I think it was right around the time of the State of the Union address, where Cornel West comes out and said, "Hey, brother, you know, you need to be true to what you said you were going to do." You know, and he said he was going to continue to hold the expectations high, continue to hold Barack Obama's feet to the fire. And so many people have not adopted that kind of mentality, and it's destructive. It's self-destructive.
Right. And Peter, I want you to tell me if you mentioned, you know, Dr. King being labeled as like the most dangerous man in America, which he was labeled by that. He was after that speech, he was no longer invited to the White House by LBJ.
Right.
You know, like so many different things, you know, much of the black community turned their backs against him. You know, mm-hmm. The folks of no heroes of mine, such as the likes of Roy Wilkins, the friggin'
right.
sellout loser. But anyways, you know, those the likes of those folks, the Urban League, really turning their back on Dr. King. And what's interesting is I see so much, like, you draw so much of a parallel, and as Cornel West, you just brought him up, you know, he calls it the Santa Clausification of
yes,
Dr.
Yes,
King.
Yes, absolutely,
and,
right. That's
and,
the point.
And him being made into this little fuzzy yes. little bunny that, you know, is looking for these chocolate eggs. Now,
mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, and I want to ask the listeners, does this right here, does this sound like a man who was a fuzzy character that was not resistance laden, was not speaking in the best interest of the poor and disenfranchised in this country, not in just in this country, but those worldwide, where he had to really come to grips with the painful, painful reality that his country, the country in which he was a citizen, was the most was the greatest purveyor of violence in the entire world. And I don't want to speak for the man. I'll let him speak in his own words.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. Religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. As I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. Connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube.
I want to go to this part of the speech. I want to fast forward to this part of the speech.
And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak not now of the soldiers of each side, not of the military government in Saigon, but simply of the people who have been under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them too because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. Now let me tell you the truth about it. They must see Americans as strange liberators. Do you realize that the Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation? And incidentally, this was before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. And this is a little known fact. And these people declared themselves independent in 1945. They quoted our Declaration of Independence in their document of freedom. Yet our government refused to recognize them. President Truman said they were not ready for independence. So we fell victim as a nation at that time of the same deadly arrogance that has poisoned the international situation for all of these years. France then set out to reconquer its former colony. And they fought eight long, hard, brutal years trying to reconquer Vietnam. You know who helped France? It was the United States of America. Came to the point that we were meeting more than 80% of the war costs. And even when France started despairing of its reckless action, we did not. And in 1954, a conference was called at Geneva, and an agreement was reached. Because France had been defeated at Dien Bien Phu.
Even after that, and even after the Geneva Accord, we did not stop. We must face the sad fact that our government sought, in a real sense, to sabotage the Geneva Accord. Well, after the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come through the Geneva Agreement. But instead, the United States came and started supporting a man named D.M., who turned out to be one of the most ruthless dictators in the history of the world. He set out to silence all opposition. People were brutally murdered merely because they raised their voices against the brutal policies of Diem. And the peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly rooted out all opposition. The peasants watched as all this was presided over by United States influence, and then by increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictatorship seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace.
So, Keita, that was just, I just wanted folks to hear those two clips of Dr. King speaking out on the war in Vietnam. And, folks that haven't heard it, I mean, just all you got to do is Google it. Just type into Google, Martin Luther King Beyond Vietnam or Martin Luther King Vietnam speech, and you'll get several sites that will pop up that have the speech in its entirety in text as well as audio. And he didn't sound like a typical, what we come to believe is your typical fuzzy pastor character that we see on T-shirts and on fans and stuff like that.
Absolutely not. That's the real Martin Luther King. And Jesus wouldn't have been nailed to a cross just for being a religious guy, an overly religious guy maybe. Martin Luther King, wasn't considered to be the most dangerous man in America by the FBI. It was J. Edgar Hoover who actually said that. That's a quote from his mouth. And that's the way the FBI proceeded in following and wiretapping and infiltrating Martin Luther King and his every action, because he was such a dangerous man, because he did come out and criticize U.S. foreign policy, and because he did come out and he started partnering with Malcolm X on bringing the United States before the U.N. For human rights abuses, and unfortunately Malcolm was struck down prematurely. We know that. And then at the end of his life, not only was Martin speaking out against Vietnam, but he was also in the process of developing a Poor People's March on Washington. And so with all these things combined, he was not to be tolerated any longer, just like Malcolm couldn't be tolerated any longer. Martin couldn't be tolerated any longer. And so, the powers that be had to take him out. I want to just notice one thing that he said. That he makes very clear the way to the perspective from which he was coming in critiquing that war was what? From the perspective of whom? The people of Vietnam. That's why when I've referred to that war a couple times during the show tonight. You don't hear me say the war in Vietnam. I specifically and intentionally say the war on the Vietnamese people, because that's what it was. It was a war on the citizens of a sovereign nation, on peasant people, on poor people. They were being slaughtered wholesale, and that's the perspective from which Martin King saw the war. saw it as a war on poor people in Vietnam, as well as all those wasted resources that would have been better spent helping poor people in the United States, as well as in Vietnam, and in any location. He realized that the staggering costs of the war in Vietnam were literally taking a food off the table and money out of the pockets of the American people, poor folks in America, and detracting and distracting from the black liberation struggle in this country. And what we don't see today, Solomon, is a voice like Martin King's coming from the Christian community and speaking out against the various imperialist wars that the United States government is still conducting. I mean, you know, we think about 1968, and here we are in 2010, and the United States is still at it, still at making warfare against brown-skinned peoples on the other side of the planet. And where's the voice of the church now? You know, where's the voice of all these good folks who are sitting up in church today because they have such ardent beliefs in this Jesus of Nazareth? Where are they? Where are they speaking out against it? I don't hear it. I don't hear the voices, man. I don't hear it. And, you know, and that's why Martin became dangerous, and that's why Martin was not the warm and fuzzy, cute and cuddly preacher caricature that people want him to be and that he's been transformed into in the modern imagination.
Right, right. And you know, when you mentioned where is the black church, with these mega black churches, if you recall, you know, many of them supported George Bush.
Oh, right.
You know, and it was because of his faith-based initiative, and so they were really willing to sell out, you know, the convictions. Where I don't know if they had any convictions or principles, but they were willing to sell themselves out, or you know, to pimp themselves out to the likes of George Bush and his administration because of his faith-based initiative and the money that they would be receiving through that faith-based initiative, and that was a ploy by the you know, that was orchestrated by the likes of Karl Rove and the Bush administration to do exactly that and to get those votes, and it worked like a charm. It worked like a charm. You know what I'm saying? Like it worked like a charm, and these folks, you know, we're you know, lock and step with that and support that, and then on top of that, and then we could keep going on and on, and it's many black churches even to this day, Peter, that despite when you talk about the oppression of brown skinned people in places and like in the Middle East, like such as like Palestine, you want to talk about the oppression and the destruction of thousands upon thousands of lives and you know, large open-air prisons. I mean, they call Gaza Strip the largest open-air prison in the entire world. And you talk about the oppression and the hell that those people are catching by the state of Israel. And you try to tell me that Martin Luther King, you know what I'm saying, Malcolm X, they would be hip to that? You know what I'm saying? Of course they wouldn't. Of course they wouldn't. But these folks, you know what I'm saying, some of these black churches, man, they use, you know what I'm saying, their own, you know, perspectives on the Bible, you know what I'm saying, to justify support of Israel.
Right.
Support of Israel. They use Jerusalem as the you know what I'm saying, the cornerstone to doing that. And it's just appalling. It's just appalling.
Really
appalling. And it leaves, you know, it leaves folks that come into church, the congregation that comes in with absolutely no point of reference in terms of Palestine. They have no point of reference of 1948. They have no point of reference of the so-called Six-Day War in 67. Right. They have no point of reference whatsoever. For God's sakes, they have no point of reference of the hell that they caught you know, a little over a year ago, the 2021 day assault that took 1,300 to 1,400 lives. You know, over half of them were children under the age of 18,
right,
in Palestine. No point of reference, and so it leaves, you know, their congregations even more confused than they were when they came in. You know what I'm saying? And they even know they're confused. And so it's one thing to, like, know that you don't know something or to know that you're confused about something, but it's another thing to not know that you're confused or that you don't know something. And that's – and so they leave, and they go out there and they parrot what they've heard in the church, and for goodness sakes, of course, they parrot what they heard in the church reinforces what they heard in the mainstream media, that a Palestinian equates to a terrorist, and that, you know, the disforce that is being inflicted upon Palestinians is somewhat justified, this, that, and the other. It's the same bullshit, xenophobic, you know what I'm saying, racist crap that, you know what I'm saying, these communities catch, and what's scary about it is that you then have black folks trumpeting, you know what I'm saying, the same kind of crap that was on a daily basis.
Is
imposed upon their communities by the same mainstream outlets that gave their preachers and ultimately them their speaking points, as if they were military heads speaking on MSNBC or CNN, as they were over a year ago when they were hired by these media outlets to really sell the war in Iraq. So it's just. And Afghanistan, it's just appalling, Peter. It's just appalling. You know what I'm saying?
It is. It's beyond appalling. Given that, like you said, the shtick of the church when it comes to looking at Palestine, Israel, Palestine, is identical to the talking points of the government, of our regressive and racist government. You know, and you know, we could devote an entire show just to this, just to the brainwashing of the church when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And you know, it's something that personally gets under my skin. I can't tell you just how infuriated I get when I hear some of these so-called preachers talking about the righteousness of the state of Israel, and when they frame this as, you know, Palestinians being terrorists, and you know, they frame this as though, you know, this is the necessary unfolding of the Book of Revelation in order to bring about the second coming, you know. And so what we're seeing is, you know, we're seeing just an utter fraudulent interpretation, misinterpretation of scripture in order, and what does it, and whose interest does it serve? It serves the interest of the U.S. government, of the military, for people to believe that, for people to think that. And so you have good Christians running around supporting Israel in their war and their terrorism against the Palestinian people, because they think that it has something to do with Jesus coming back. You know, and you talk about appalling and ridiculous, and just insane and inane. There's not enough words to describe how ridiculous that is, just what a gross misinterpretation of scripture that is when preachers get up and talk about Revelation in terms of Israel today, and saying that, you know, this is a necessary unfolding in order to bring about the second coming. It is an absolute obscenity.
Exactly. And it's and you know, to draw from King's speech, he spoke about DM. And the support of dictators. In South Vietnam, you know, murderous dictators that you know, killed off any kind of opposition to him, you know, and when we look at the support, I mean, the U.S. finances Israel, you know what I'm saying, something like the tune of, I believe it's something around like $5 to $6 million per week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a great website for information on that, folks, is If Americans Knew. Yeah, If Americans Knew, just Google that, because I'm not sure if it's .com or .org, but if you just go to If Americans Knew, and it you know, it should come up, and there's a lot of data on there, But, you know, we're talking about $6 million a week, and much of that goes to military purposes. You know, we're talking about Black Hawk helicopters. We're talking about Israel has the second largest fleet of F-16s in the world outside of the U.S. And, you know, and what are these weapons? What are these weapons and machinery being used for? They're being used for death and destruction.
Let's look at one weapon in particular, and we'll see all that we need to know. What nation has the greatest nuclear capabilities outside of the United States and Russia?
No, Israel.
Israel. And you know, if you can look at a map, if anybody who's listening can look at a map, just to give that some geographical context, look at the size of Israel on the global map, and notice that Israel has the largest stockade of nuclear weapons outside of the United States and Russia. And what does that mean, especially in the current debate that's going on even as we speak, when the United States is outraged and undone by their presumption that Iran wants to develop nuclear energy? And, you know, and we've heard George Bush talk about it, and we're hearing Barack Obama talk about it, and we're hearing all the senators saber-rattling that they're not going to allow Iran to achieve nuclear capabilities, nuclear power, and so on and so forth. Well, first of all, who is the United States to say anything about that when they are supporting and funding and arming the state of Israel with an enormous stockpile of nuclear weapons? Somehow or another, Israel and their defiance of the UN Charter and the deproliferation treaties, somehow that's ignored, that's overlooked. You know, if Americans knew, well, that's something most Americans don't know about. And, you know, so this conversation about Iran and Ahmadinejad and his and their move toward nuclear energy and nuclear power and perhaps nuclear weaponry, we have to put in conversation with Israel and Israel's connection to the United States in terms of nuclear weaponry. So it's utter hypocrisy, nothing short of hypocrisy and two-facedness for the United States to decry anything that Iran does in relation to its role and its relationship to Israel.
Right, it's just looked it up. It's if Americans knew that. Org. I didn't know whether it was .com or .org, but it's ifamericansknew.org. Folks, as you hear this, whether it's live or on archive, go to that website, and it's self-explanatory. It is self-explanatory, and you know, I don't have to say anymore. It is by far, words speak for themselves, and like I said before, once again, it's self-explanatory. If you just go to ifamericansknew.org and just, you know, just take a glimpse and see what your government is spending. Well, I guess if you're listening, I just found out that we have some listeners in the UK. So, but then again, your British government is also supporting them. So it would just look there and just take a glimpse in terms of what the U.S. government has been doing, you know, with a good portion of its money in terms of financing Israel, and I'm glad you mentioned that Peter, is that, I mean, they're the only nuclear power in the Middle East. I mean, they're only nuclear power in the Middle East. And what's interesting is you see the hypocrisy is amazing, is that these nations that have basically been the ones who have used like the most excessive force are the ones that seem to think that they have the moral authority to walk around and tell other nations what they can or cannot do.
Exactly.
But you know, the U.S. to this date is the only country in the entire world that has used a nuclear weapon. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Dropping
right.
two
there's
atomic bombs.
Yeah, there's an inconvenient truth for you.
Exactly. And if that was like some other country, say that was like, I don't know, say Iran was the only country that whatever, they would be harping on it, saying this is why they need to be disarmed. This is why they should not, you know, have the capability to enrich uranium, this, that, and the other, because they have used, they've been harping on it, but they would be, that would be their main selling point. Is like, look what they did when they had a nuclear weapon in their arsenal. They dropped one, they dropped a second one, and but then you look at the U.S. The U.S. has is the only country to use nuclear weapons on another country,
right?
Taking out hundreds of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people. Wasn't nothing.
And let's go back to the notion of narrative. Okay, now that you've mentioned Nagasaki and Hiroshima and those the brutal annihilation of those Japanese citizens and the narrative behind that, because there's probably some listeners, especially folks our age, who are going to say, well, you know, that was necessary. They needed to do that to end the war. Well, that is the narrative that has been perpetrated by the winners, by the United States, by Britain, that the United States needed to drop those bombs to end the war. And dropping those bombs, even though it cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, that it probably saved the lives of millions of people. Well, that is an out-and-out lie. It is an out-and-out lie. The United States did not need to drop those bombs. Japan was on the brink of surrendering. Japanese dignitaries were in conversation with not only United States diplomats, but also with Soviet diplomats, Russian diplomats, talking about how we could end this war, to bring it to an end. The United States dropped those bombs out of political motivations to get an edge on the Soviet Union in terms of the tilting of power on the Asian continent. And so the United States did not need to drop those bombs at all. That's an out-and-out lie. So for those of you that have heard that and have been told that and have been taught that, and that's what's in your history books, go back and check it out for yourself. You know, find out the truth about it. Try not find out the facts about it. That Truman was not some humanitarian bomb dropping. I mean, just listen to the insanity of what that sounds like. And we'll see that was the ruthless and unnecessary murder of tens of thousands of Japanese citizens, non-military citizens. And so it's exactly that kind of rewriting of history that we see with Jesus, the Jesus of Nazareth, who the real Jesus has become this character, you know, that we see particularly on days like today, on the Christian Easter holiday and Christian Christmas holiday, the character that Martin Luther King has been morphed into, and also, you know, other narratives that have been rewritten. The facts have been changed. If anybody's read 1984, you know how the facts were just tossed down the memory hole,
right?
You know, and history was written by the winners to suit their agenda, to suit their needs. And so that's another instance of that, and what that means, we need to understand that, and how that shaped the end of World War II and everything that followed it. And so, yeah, the United States is the only country to ever use nuclear power, nuclear weaponry, at any time. And so for the United States to pontificate to other countries is utter hypocrisy, utter hypocrisy.
Exactly, and have supported some of the most brutal regimes, you know, from Suharto and Indonesia. You know what I'm saying? And you know, it, you know, 24 hours before, actually, yeah, it was like 28 to 40 hours before, he inflicted that genocide amongst the people in East Timor. You know,
mm-hmm.
Gerald Ford. You know, it was Gerald Ford and Kissinger that were there, and he told them that he was going to do it. He told them that he was going to do it, and they said, "Listen, bro, we ain't got no problem with you doing that. Just wait till we get the F out of Dodge, because what's it going to look like when this crap goes down and we're in your country? Let us get out. Let's get out of Dodge, and then you could do whatever you want. You know what I'm saying? And you know, next thing you know, over 250,000." Folks were murdered by the U.S. supported military backed, you know what I'm saying, in terms of weaponry given to the ruthless murderous dictatorship of Suharto, you know.
Right.
So and so they, that's what they do, is they They support dictators. I mean, even to present day. I mean, look at Mubarak and everyone from Mubarak in Egypt, who was a ruthless scoundrel, to Uribe in Colombia. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, look at what these governments have done, from killing, you know, Coca-Cola union organizers in Colombia to what Mubarak does. I mean, the dude is a ruthless dictator. But he has
look at how the mainline media was applauding, took another opportunity to applaud Augusto Pinochet when, you know, the earthquake that rocked Chile a few weeks back. You know, they were saying that it didn't have the same effects as the debacle in Haiti, even though it was a stronger earthquake technically. And they were saying that's because of the good things and the great infrastructure that was built by Augusto Pinochet. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you talk about rewriting the narrative. I mean, they're just fabricating a complete rewrite of history by making that statement, by making those claims. Yet still, most folks who read that newspaper will read that and say, "Oh, wow, I didn't know that." You know, thank goodness for that Pinochet guy and all the good things he did. You know, and so just like that, the truth does a complete 180, and you know, and myth becomes fact, and lies become truth, and the narrative is changed, and people just, you know, continue to march along in ignorance, and it's dangerous, you know. And so, you know, that's the value of this kind of a show, is, you know, to call out that kind of foolishness, those kind of lies, and to oppose the rewriting of history, to oppose the rewriting of a narrative, and to oppose the agenda that just continues to oppress and bamboozle the population.
Yeah, you're right. And folks, I mean, that are listening, I mean, many of you guys, you know, I know a lot of folks that listen to the show regularly are comrades of ours that are fellow activists that this is no new news to them. But, you know, folks who are listening to the show, you know, for the first or second time, you know, it's important to send this link out to as many of your you know, your networks as possible. So instead of sending these, like, chain emails that are of no significance and merit, you know, send out links, you know, whether it's Black Agenda Report or Counterpunch, just, you know, and tell folks, you know, just take the time to read an article, or, you know what I'm saying, or listen to a podcast, you know, once a day, you know what I'm saying, or geez, if you can't do once a day, every other day, because if we don't continually to expand our base, and when I mean base, I'm talking about base of well-informed folks that really understand these issues on a basic level and understand the history and the derivation of these issues, so that, you know, that they can't be rewritten to them in some falsified, you know what I'm saying, very ambiguous way that will have you, you know, like Malcolm said. I mean, just to steal a line from Malcolm, I was trying to think of the right words to explain it, but I'll just borrow Malcolm's words. He said, if you don't, to paraphrase him, he was talking about papers, but I'm going to spread it to, like, you know, mainstream media in general. But he said, if you don't really understand, you know, what you're reading with mainstream, you know, papers in the U.S., you know, they'll have you, pretty much to paraphrase them, they'll have you celebrating and praising the oppressors and hating the oppressors and the folks that are being oppressed, and that's exactly what the corporate media does. It confuses folks, it gets folks, you know what I'm saying, and Americans, they have this comfort where they can just sit back and watch news and not even give a damn. Watch it, see, oh, you know what I'm saying, 1,400 Palestinians were killed in 20 days, you know, and just really, you know, you have couple classes of folks. You have one class of folks that watches it and just doesn't give a damn, and then you have another class that watches it and right there and cheers and says, yeah, that's, you know, take out those terrorists, you know what I'm saying, because they've been programmed, you know what I'm saying, to believe.
There you go. Right,
and to be xenophobic, and that they, yes, they are, you know what I'm saying, they deserved it, yeah, and so what, you know, this, that, and the other. Listen, if we don't expand the base of folks that are well-informed, the world is doomed. The world is doomed because everything is not the land of milk and honey. So much of the evil that is being perpetrated throughout the world is derived from policies that emanate from Washington, and mm-hmm. and if those things don't and dare I say Wall Street also from Wall Street,
absolutely, yeah,
global economic financial crisis, you know, so
yes,
Peter, it's really, you know what I'm saying, that it's critical that folks take it upon themselves to become educated, and then the next step is to really study how to organize themselves, how to join coalitions, to join up with organizations that are organized, and to be a part of those, and to be that groundswell, that grassroots groundswell that is much like those mental midgets called the tea baggers or tea parties,
yeah, right.
But to work as a positive force to counter and to put pressure on this government for things that it is not doing, things that it is doing. It's not going to come, as Frederick Douglass said, it is not going to come without, power conceives nothing without demand. And he said it's like, you know, expecting, you know, if you don't expect struggle in some kind of fight, it's like expecting, you know, rain with no thunder, you know.
Without struggle, there is no progress.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really incumbent on all of us, including myself and yourself, to really continue to spread the word, to be those inconvenient heroes, to be that thorn in their side by organizing, by putting pressure, and defying through resistance, even if it's even like it's on so many different levels. And holidays, yes, and I do say holidays, and repudiating holidays, and not just like
exactly.
The religious ones, but the Columbus days. I mean,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? The Columbus Day is one of the most heinous holidays, and in its essence, you know, celebrating that holiday is basically the celebration of continued, you know what I'm saying? You're basically saying I celebrate
genocide.
Violence and genocide of people, you know what I'm saying? Whether they're in the indigenous folks in the U.S. or indigenous folks in the Middle East or indigenous Africans, you know what I'm saying, in sub-Saharan Africa, it's really, really important that we start to, like, psychologically, mentally resist, everything from holidays to these policies, domestic and foreign, and
to use another Malcolm X term, on brainwashing. You know, he talked about having
right.
a whole generation to unbrainwash. You know, and that's understanding that we have been brainwashed. You know, through the textbooks that we were mistaught out of in school. The misrepresentation of reality through corporate news. You know, we need to be very intentional and purposeful about our own unbrainwashing, and that goes back to what you just said and what you put out there every time we do a broadcast, and it's so important that folks spread the word about our show, spread the word about other independent media outlets who are getting the truth out there and who are challenging the status quo, the word from on high, from the corporate mouthpieces of the news media. And, that's part of that unbrainwashing. And those themselves are acts of resistance, you know, repudiating these holidays and repudiating the falsified narratives of history, and challenging the interpretation of news that comes down through the corporate media. Those are acts of defiance right there, and those are acts of resistance. And those need to be acknowledged and celebrated and then built on. So you know, every step is significant, and every person is significant, you know, and that's why that falling into that Messiah syndrome is so dangerous, to believe that, well, I'm not important, I'm not significant, we're waiting for a savior, we're waiting for a hero, we're waiting for, you know, a general to come get the troops together. No, we are the troops. We don't need a general. We're all generals at the same time, whatever. And it's up to us. It's incumbent upon us to stand in solidarity with one another, with our brothers and sisters across the globe of whatever complexion, of whatever stripe, whatever disposition and background. That's what's important, and those are acts of resistance.
Right, and not accepting everything that's popular. You know, just because something or someone is popular does not mean that you support it wholesale and you support their philosophies and say, oh, because so-and-so said this about Obama and they were very complimentary and saying that we need to support them. There's a reason why that person was promulgated on that corporate media station, because they expected him or her to say that. And their criticism of Obama, they knew it was only going to go so far. And there's a reason why, you know, other folks will not be put on corporate media airwaves, whether it be television or radio airwaves, because they know that those folks cannot be compromised. They cannot be compromised by the flash and the bait of you know, 15 minutes of fame or 5 minutes of fame, which might equate to some money to sell their books, this, that, and the other. And you know, we're going to have a nice conversation within the next few weeks or so. I don't know when, but we're going to have a nice conversation on the so-called false prophets, the coming age of these public intellectuals that try to trumpet themselves around as disciples of W.E.B. Du Bois, but haven't done a damn thing close to what the significance of what Du Bois did in terms of, you know, him being playing a significant role in the founding of the Pan-Africanist Congress. Obviously, we know, you know, his work with the NAACP and him being one of the founders. But so much, he was a Pan-Africanist to the core. Their books, like my favorite, The World in Africa, you know, Carsey Woodson, these folks were intellectuals that spent the vast majority of their lives trying to give back to the community. And so when I see these like handkerchief head black and so-called black public intellectuals allowing themselves to be pimped and prostituted from CNN to MSNBC to what have you, just so they can speak on basically nothing. They have no constructive criticism. They have no harsh criticism for the current conditions in which black folks are faced now. It's just, you know, they won't get to the root. I mean, they're nothing better than the white liberals that we see that like to put, you know, band-aids on you know, 10-inch gashes on the arm of black and brown skin communities, you know, and that gash being caused by the knife and the axe, him saying, and the sickle of white supremacy and institutional racism. They walk around and they couldn't give a damn less. They care. They love being put on TV and being trumpeted around, and some of them like to drop little hip hop phrases to be cool. And unfortunately, we buy right into it, Peter. We buy, oh yeah, yeah, oh, he's so cool, man. He's so bad. He's down. Yeah, this, that, and the other.
Right.
He's down. But,
yeah,
but beyond that, there's nothing. They're hollow.
Right. Yeah. Sarah Palin, somebody in that circle that, you know, they interviewed LL Cool J. You know, so that's their badge of honor now. You know, hey, we had this black person on our show. So yeah, now that proves that, you know, that we're down with the struggle, you know. I mean, come on.
Right. And with that, I see that we've had a good spirited show, and folks, we have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to say on behalf of Peter Fowler and myself, You've been listening to Your World News. Check us out. We will have another episode before Wednesday. Just don't know which day it is, but just check the website. The great thing about it is you can catch all the episodes on archive. If you can't catch us live, you can catch every episode on archive. And like Peter said, we just got to keep, we have to keep resisting, and we have to keep, you know, doing that work. And so we thank you for your support, and we support you. We're in struggle with you and in resistance with you every step of the way. Once again, this is Solomon. On behalf of Peter Fowler, thank you for listening to Your World News. We'll see you next time.
Peace.